Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with James Lee Burke, who's back with A Private Cathedral, his 40th book and the 23rd in the beloved Dave Robichaux series. We'll also hear from Stephanie Swallow, a Lake Charles native, whose new story collection is Last One Out, Please Shut Off the Lights. James Lee Burke is a modern master of the mystery novel. His books are set in his native Texas and his beloved beleaguered Louisiana, where Detective Dave Robichaux and his sidekick Cleet Purcell, the Bobbsey twins from Homicide, keep tilting at windmills and bad guys. He's received many honors for his work, including the Grandmaster Award and two Edgar Awards for the best novel from the Mystery Writers of America. Today, we're celebrating the publication of his 40th book, amazing, A Private Cathedral, the 23rd in his Dave Robichaux series. And we're speaking to Jim from his home in Montana. Jim Burke, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Well, thanks for having me on your show again, Susan.
Oh, Jim, what an achievement. You know, I was just thinking back to the first time I interviewed you. It was maybe 30 years ago, and and you were coming back after this kind of long, dry spell, and the Lost Get Back Boogie was your kind of return ticket, but it took a long trip. That book was under submission for a long time and was rejected a lot. And I remember that you said, if you just keep stepping up to the plate and playing the game, at the end of it, you'll be surprised by the numbers on the board.
That's right. That's what I said.
No. Are you ever surprised? Do you surprise yourself?
I had a long period. It was 13 years in the middle of my career in which I was out of hardback print. I wrote all those years, but I couldn't sell anything. I still have novels that I wrote during that period that are unpublished. But anyway, it was The Lost Get Back Boogie, published by LSU Press, that put me back in hardback print, and it changed my whole career. No question about it. And I've never been able to really, in my mind, pay the debt I owe them.
But then you began the Robichaux series, and you'll never be out of print again.
Well, I hope not.
I mean, that's, you have the last laugh in every conceivable way. Oh, now all of your books have a great element of spiritual reckoning in them, and as any reader can guess from the title, A Private Cathedral is one of those books. It's really very special. And in this one, Dave and Cleet face the thing, who may be their fiercest enemy yet, this sort of creature named Gideon Rachetti, and he is one of the all-time worst villains you've ever come up with, and that is saying something. So talk about making up that character.
Well, the character in the book, a figure who transports himself from the year 1600 into Louisiana, just before the towers, the 9/11 occurred. This book is set back in time,
right,
about 21 years. But it's a story of the Renaissance and a feud between two Florentine families that has been sustained all these years, and it's been transported to the United States, and it continues on. It's a classical tale. Actually, I used as background the story of Isolde and Tristan, the two lovers who are separated in time. It's out of, in other words, a Celtic legend. And my work's heavily influenced by Elizabethan theater and classical mythology and the Bible. I've I've always written tales that have their origin in mythology. But that, anyway, it's supposed to be, my intention is, though, to write about modern times. And this fellow Rossetti was the torturer man that worked for the Inquisition. He did horrible things to people. And he's been condemned to be the oversight man on a prison galleon. And what he's trying to do by traveling into modern times is to redeem his soul. And the book deals, it's the third book in a trilogy, it stands by itself, but deals actually with the coming of a dark figure, a figure who has been waiting in the wings for a long time. His antecedents are Sir Huey Long, Joseph McCarthy, and Joseph Wallace. But that fellow has, it's his time in history and his ascendancy, as Dave Robichaux, Cleet Purcell discovers, the thing we have feared for a long time has become personified.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with James Lee Burke, who's back with A Private Cathedral, his 40th book and the 23rd in the beloved Dave Robichaux series. The title is so lovely, and I don't think I'm giving too much away when I say that A Private Cathedral, the private cathedral of the title, is a moment of spiritual refuge that we carry with us internally as a place we can go. And when Dave tells us about his, I realized that it was also one of yours. When I read that story, I remembered you telling me that story from your childhood.
Yeah.
And it was like a little gift in this book. That's like the private cathedral is one of your purest moments of childhood happiness, being connected with nature, being part of something bigger. You, learning something, laughing at something. So much is crystallized in that one moment. And I think you're telling us all that that's what we need to have. Am I right?
Yeah, I think you got it. I think, again, this is Dave Robichaux's view of things, but I share them. A person makes a contract at some point. A person who seeks the informed life, as Socrates called. Person who seeks enlightenment to reach a moment where he lives an intelligent life, he makes a private contract with some power outside of himself. It can be a religion or a religious figure, but it's a little voice actually hears inside of him, and he has a cathedral he lives inside, and he's the only person in that environment. It's full of burst of light coming through a stained glass window. But he makes his contract, his troth, a medieval knight would call it.
Right.
He makes his troth with this figure. And from that day on, he doesn't count the score. You don't count the score anymore. You set aside all the dross of the world and you accept fate for what it is, but you never compromise your principles, and you, in effect, just step into eternity at that moment. That's been my experience. And you don't have to argue with people anymore. You don't have to contend with the world. You don't have to justify yourself. You step out of one place into another, and that's your private cathedral.
So here you are, 40 books, and you've been wrestling with all these same ideas, and you've been with Dave for 23 of these books. Will there be a 24th? Are you already into a 24th?
I already wrote it.
Ah!
But it's a book, it's a sequel to The Jealous Kind.
Oh, all right. All right. I love those books.
The Pillars of Heaven. That story of migrant workers in 1962 in Colorado.
So how do you feel when you look at that bookshelf of yours with all these books in all these languages, almost every language in the world?
Well, I feel very fortunate. I
But you've worked hard.
Well, I that's true, but, you know, we had a lot of bad years, and it's hard to make a living as a writer, but anyway, I was fortunate. I have a great family, too, that always believed in my ability and stayed with me, we worked every dirty job there is, and this is a fact, from Florida to California to every place.
You do have that traditional kind of writer's resume, you know, landman for an oil company, social worker, teacher. You can just strike them all off the list. It's an amazing experience, but it filters through in all these books in so many ways.
It shows also a kind of shaky employment history.
And then finally you settle down at the desk, man.
I'm just kidding you. But, I got a great family. We have four children. And, you know, my wife and I have been married 60 years.
That's something.
Yeah.
That is something. Well, it's great to see a writer who deserves a great life. You've worked for this so hard. We've been talking with James Lee Burke, whose 40th book is A Private Cathedral. Jim, heartfelt congratulations, and thank you for years of happy reading.
Oh, thank you, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds if we're together?
Stephanie Swallow's amazing short stories envelop us in the rich, muggy atmosphere of South Louisiana. She grew up in Lake Charles, which figures prominently in many of those stories. Today, we're talking with her from her pandemic refuge in Maine, but she teaches at the University of Chicago. Her first book is Last One Out, Shut Off the Lights. Stephanie Swallow, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan. I feel so honored to be here.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
So what's your Louisiana story? How did growing up in Lake Charles inform your writing life?
Well, I was raised by a single mother and my extended family. My grandparents were Cajuns from around Mamou and Vidry.
Mm-hmm.
So they were French speakers, and they moved to Lake Charles in the 50s after the war, like a lot of young couples did from those smaller Cajun towns, and they set up a little neighborhood, and I grew up in that neighborhood, and our neighbors were also in the same kind of situation. They were French speakers from the country who had come to the city, and so I was always surrounded by stories and different colors of language and the spoken French and the Cajun accented English
and music too.
There were some dancers in the neighborhood who were absolutely astounding. Those old folks who can really cut a rug in every wedding. So that was my childhood. It was really idyllic in that way. And I was, you know, growing up in this sort of sheltered little village at the same time that region, Lake Charles, and its dependence on the petrochemical industry is, I'm sure, widely known in Louisiana. And the oil crash was in full swing. And so it was an economically depressed area that was happening outside of this little bubble, you know, and it was affected my uncles who were often out of work, laid off from the plant.
And that explains the title of your book, too.
Yes, it does. That Last One Out, Shut Off the Lights, I remember appearing on kind of cheeky bumper stickers around that time, you know, when businesses were pulling up stakes and young people were leaving. And yeah, so there was always this tension between a strong sense of home and also a feeling that it was collapsing outside of this immediate, you know, comfort zone.
So when did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
I think I've always loved listening to stories. My dad was also a great storyteller. My grandparents were good storytellers, and my grandmother was. And I think I came to an appreciation of the value of stories, and especially of written stories, as I was entering middle school, high school. I was kind of a weird kid, you know, like most writers are, you know. You mm-hmm. have sort of your own point of view. And I found refuge in books, like many writers do, especially since my family, they're incredibly smart people, and they're incredibly capable people, but they're not bookish people. My grandmother was a little bit. When I would have a question, she would take me to the encyclopedia. She had an old set of, like, you know, 1965 World Book Encyclopedias. That was her gesture toward encouraging curiosity.
And so now nobody grows up with encyclopedias anymore.
No,
isn't that sad?
I don't, you know, it's interesting. I still have that set of encyclopedias and all the markings that we made in it.
Yeah.
The information gets out of date so fast, you know, it becomes a cultural object more than an information source at a certain point. But,
oh, so true.
Yeah.
Now, you've been studying your craft for a long time. You were at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. You were a Stegner Fellow at Stanford, and you've been publishing as well. So it's really terrific to have these stories as a collection, because they're such a Louisiana portrait when they're all together.
Yes. These stories were written over a long span of time. Some of them date back to my MFA days, which is, goodness, almost 20 years ago. And then the newest one I wrote specifically for the collection. So they are, you know, a portrait of my changing relationship to the place and changing understanding of the place, and also of my changing aesthetic approach, I guess. When I first started writing stories, I was writing sort of in that Flannery O'Connor, you know, country voice mode, you know, a lot of Southern writers, I think, start out with. The Southern voice is so strong, and it's such a beautiful storytelling voice. But I had a wonderful mentor at University of Iowa named James Allen McPherson, who he won the Pulitzer Prize in 1978, I think, for a beautiful collection of stories called Elbow Room. Mm-hmm. But he gave me the best piece of advice I've ever gotten about fiction writing. He knew about my working-class background, my Cajun upbringing, but also that I'd gone to college at the University of Chicago and had this sort of white-collar education, and he advised me to maybe use both of those languages that I knew, you know, maybe not to trap myself so completely within the sometimes limited Southern country dialect, but instead expand outward and allow this other voice that I had learned to come to the fore. So I hope that this collection represents those different languages that I've learned to speak, and also through those languages, the very textured and multifaceted cultural experience of being there.
Well, one of the great things you do, in addition to such fantastic language, is voice, the great Southern voices that are in this collection. And so I wonder if you'd read a little bit from a story called Poke Salad.
Oh, I would love to. Thank you for asking. Poke Salad. Yesterday, your old daddy just about checked out, let me tell you. There's a song on one of these long plays you sent last year for Christmas. Poke Salad Annie, Gator's Got Your Granny, something like that. Well, old Poke Salad Annie and her no-count daddy don't have a thing to eat. So Annie goes out and picks her daddy a mess of greens in what they call a poke sack, which is, I believe, how the plant got its name. Now, that song sounds pretty good coming out of those speakers I put together last year. Good sound! Since your old daddy got retired from the plant, he's got a lot of time to just sit and think. I put on the long plays and watch the boats just easing down the river, and I start to feel sort of romantic, like old Ishmael. How did old Ishmael put it? I rejoice in my spine. Whoa! Whoa! I get thoroughly philosophical with some good sounds, baby doll. Now, I know I'm talking your ear off, and I can tell I woke you up, but I forget the time difference. And to tell you the truth, I'm making some pretty good progress on my Heinekens here. You can't fault your old daddy for that. But getting back to poke salad, it grows down here, and people do eat it. You can probably find it growing wild out in California, too. Look it up. P-O-K-E. Salad. Right. Like salad. Well, the water went down.
Sorry.
Did you want me to stop there?
Yes. Okay. But thank you. That was so... I was thinking, I can just sit here and listen to her for another 20 minutes.
I have that voice all day.
Oh, God, I love that story so much.
Thank you.
So thanks. Oh, God.
What's remarkable about that one is that it's basically a transcript of a conversation I had with my dad. He had such a wonderful sense of humor, and just soaring intelligence and wide-ranging curiosity, and an artistic sensibility, but also a sense of humor about himself. So he told this tall tale about Misstep eating this weed that he picked out of his yard. Who knows what it was?
Oh, well, that's a gift. That's a gift when you get a story like that. So what's it like to be somewhere so far away, you know, in Maine or Chicago, and you're willing yourself back to Louisiana?
Yeah, I mean, I feel in some ways always closely connected to the place. My family mm-hmm. is still there, my aunts and uncles, and I try to visit as often as I can, though obviously it's been hard since this pandemic started. But I think the most comfortable relationship that I can have with Louisiana has been one of longing, and maybe not nostalgia, some nostalgia, I suppose, but a longing for the place has been the best way for me to orient myself to home. Mm-hmm. When I'm there, I, you know, it's like a child returning to her basement bedroom and her parents'
house. Oh, yeah.
You know?
As many people are these days.
Yes, as many people are these days. Like the relationship I have with the place is more complicated, I think, than I can mm-hmm. quite enjoy when I'm there. But I'd love to go back there and rekindle it and know how the place shaped me.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Stephanie Swallow, author of Last One Out, Please Shut Off the Lights. My very favorite story is The Boucherie, in which a neighborhood comes together to host a halal slaughter of a cow. Yes. And this cow has come to them in a very circuitous way. So talk a little bit about that story. This story is just a masterpiece.
I mean, oh, thank you.
I've read it like 3 times now, and every time I read it, I'm just like, wow.
thank you for saying
that. It's so rich. It's so rich. So talk a little bit about writing that story.
Well, I think, you know, that story was an act of optimism on my part, and was based on observations of my, you know, my own grandparents and that little community in Lake Charles of Cajuns who kept to their sort of country ways in some respects. They still sort of bartered with each other and would trade the figs off the tree in the backyard for, you know, fresh chicken or whatever. And there was a lot of sharing of resources. And setting that against what was just blatantly racism, you know, it's not mm-hmm. uncommon. It's not a mystery down there. They would say things about Black people. They were concerned about Black parts of town encroaching. They would say things about immigrants. But also, when someone was right in front of them, they were incredibly hospitable and welcoming. I wanted to capture that ambivalence toward the other who might be encroaching on a neighborhood, or might be, you know, be felt to be encroaching on a neighborhood, but at the same time, the community feels a sense of tenderness toward them, or if they can open their kitchens or their, you know, garages in this case, to include them, then...
In this case, there's a cow in the garage.
Yes, a cow. They can share their meat, you know?
You know, when somebody loses a cow by the side, you know, a truckload of cows, nothing goes to waste.
Yeah, that actually happened. I don't know if you remember that story.
It had the ring of truth, my dear.
Yeah, I think they've since fixed that overpass, but...
Oh, God. But the neighbors, the new neighbors who are part of this ritual are Fatima and Khalid, who are from the Sudan.
Yes.
It's an odd kind of inclusion, and it's an inclusion on their terms, and it's just a very interesting way to put people together.
Yeah, I think I was interested, too, in how little they would know about each other, especially how little the Cajuns would know about these people who had moved in, who look... sort of, you know, they were North African. They might be Indian, might be Black, not quite sure.
Yeah.
And so their resource for this would be the out-of-date information and the encyclopedias on their shelf.
Which I love. I love that, reading the encyclopedia to find out about Sudan.
I mean, that's their way of trying.
Right, I know.
And there's a lot of misunderstanding in the efforts to understand.
And Louisiana also figures in your new book, Your Work in Progress.
It does, yes. I've just been reading a lot of archival articles from the Baton Rouge Advocate about the oil spill in 2010, which is going to be the spine of the book, and it'll deal with issues of coastal erosion and loss of home, but also several chapters delve way back into the past and sort of trace the Acadian exodus from France to Nova Scotia to Louisiana, and ask, you know, I guess the central question of the book is how to make a home when mm-hmm. home keeps disappearing under your feet.
Well, I can't wait. I know it'll take a while, but I can't wait.
I'm working real hard. I've got a deadline in December. So.
All right. All right. We've been talking with Stephanie Swallow, whose new story collection is Last One Out, Shut Off the Lights. Stephanie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Oh, Lake Charles. Oh, Lake Charles. Now, this little ditty was named after the city where I was born.
Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.